Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaskan Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. In the age of mass production, the term luthier may not be familiar to many people. Fairbanks musician and craftsman Greg Pacetti talks about being a luthier and creating dobros, guitars, and ukuleles.
Beauty has a big play on it. Most of the standard luthier woods have those properties, but you know, you could buy the ideal rosewood, which is Brazilian rosewood, and if you don't build it properly, it ain't going to sound better because it's Brazilian rosewood.
NUA Museum of the North's exhibit director, Roger Topp, took a voyage on the research vessel Sekuliak last summer. He talks about his research background and approach to communicating his passion for science.
I tell everybody, look, if I'm going to write about this cruise, I am a part of the story. It's creative nonfiction, right? I want to use whatever sort of literary tools I have to tell a story.
All that in Cotexa Clippings. I hope you'll join us. Today's show is about our sometimes hidden passions exercised outside of the workplace. For the sake of transparency, I must mention I've been friends with my first guest, musician, craftsman, and instrument maker Greg Pacetti for years. Greg has installed cabinets and built countertops in our home, and he's built homes for other friends. But unless you're a local musician, you may not know, Greg also creates beautiful-looking and sounding string instruments. And he's a fine musician himself. He and his wife, Marcia Trainer, produced a CD of his songs called Sunday Drive. Not long ago, I had the chance to visit Greg in his shop and saw various forms and partially constructed ukuleles and guitars around the workplace. I'm ashamed to say, it was only then that I realized, A, I knew nothing about what it takes to build a good-looking and sounding string instrument, and B, that discussing with Greg the art of being a luthier would make for a great feature on the show. You're listening right now to Greg, who I sometimes call by his nickname Grady, strumming a few bars on his latest passion, the ukulele. I began our discussion by asking him about his boyhood in St. Augustine, Florida.
That's where Dad was born and where I was born.
Do you have any brothers and sisters?
One sister and a brother. My sister and I grew up there when we were little tiny kids. Then we moved to Fort Myers, Florida. That's where he kept his boat.
And how was the shrimp business in his day when he was a fisherman?
Was it good money, you mean?
Yeah.
The shrimp industry in that region of the United States started on the Atlantic side of Florida up by St. Augustine. They pretty much fished it to death and then realized there's a lot of shrimp around on the Gulf side. That's why my dad moved to the Gulf side to Fort Myers. My granddaddy also had several boats, and he discovered a lot of good fishing in the Gulf as well, and that's kind of where it moved to as far as general history of it. And my granddad was the first fisherman to use the cat diesel in a fishing vessel, which was a very big deal. Even
really?
Though it doesn't sound like much, that's what Dad's boats always had, was a diesel, but early on, they had gasoline engines, and they caught on fire and had all kinds of problems. At one time, when I was a young teenager, I read an article about my granddad frontiering that particular engine.
Was it a dangerous occupation?
Yeah, but not as bad as Pacific. All fishing is pretty dangerous, especially when you get into deep water. Deep water would be like over 100 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
There are fishing that's 12 and bay fishing and all that, that's probably a lot safer.
Mm.
The fishing's kind of dangerous.
And you never considered being a fisherman as an occupation?
I considered it, but I didn't consider it for very long. I would have had to stop thinking about being a gypsy, which Dad didn't like very much. Now, what I mean by gypsy is mean I wanted to travel and kind of go hang out in Europe.
Yeah. Well, but this is also in the 60s and 70s when a lot of young people were doing that.
Yeah, there was a kind of a gypsy kind of thing going on. I guess you're right. So that's kind of what I did as far as not wanting to buckle down and become a fisherman. And the buckling down to become a fisherman, you basically have to make payments on a boat and all the goods to go out and do a trip, you know, 2 weeks to a month. And, you know, it's quite a responsibility, and I didn't want any responsibility at that time.
Well, also being a gypsy and travel around in the military when you were in the Air Force, didn't you travel to various parts of the world in the Air Force?
Well, I got stationed in Germany, and while I was a GI, I did some travel on leave down to Spain, up to Amsterdam, and around in Germany and Belgium, Luxembourg, and, you know, a few places that were not far away. It was very interesting. Roman ruins everywhere. The history was just gobbled you up everywhere you went, you know.
And then after you got out of the service, you went back to Germany.
Yeah, I got out and made a few bucks and went right back over and hung out with my German girlfriend that I had when I was a GI, same lady. And she was in college and I was just hanging with her and playing my guitar. My guitar was with me all the time.
When did you first get a guitar, Grady?
When I was about 12 or 13. It was a piece of junk. It was a harmony guitar. I think it was a classical first time. Second time was an arch top.
Well, did you ever think you would eventually be building guitars or instruments?
No. Like many people, I thought it was mystical that someone could create a musical instrument, in particular a stringed instrument. I had read about some luthiers when I was in Germany.
But and luthier is the name for a guitar maker?
It's someone that I think makes and repairs stringed instruments. Okay. That could be a violin to a guitar.
Okay.
I got a little bit interested when I was a GI, but no, I didn't see myself doing that. It was when I came to Alaska that I decided, oh, I can make one of those.
Well, let's cover a little bit of ground to get you to Alaska. You've always been handy, and you said that you used to make wallets to make a few bucks when you were in Germany.
When I was stationed in Germany, I got interested in working with leather, and that probably had to do with going to Spain and seeing some items sold to tourists, purses and beautiful work. It's hard to describe. There's one right there. See that leather bag over there?
I do, yeah.
That was made just like I made my bags.
You made that?
Yeah. Yeah, I made that many, many years ago.
It's pretty durable that it lasted so long.
Well, leather is like that. Anyhow, I got interested in leather when I was a GI. I made a number of items, some purses. I just jumped right in, you know. It's, if you look at a lot of things with any kind of clear eyeball, you know, take a good look, you'll figure out how to make it. You just got to get a few tools and jump in, you know.
Well, A, I've never been handy that way, and B, it scares me that I'm going to screw something up and do some damage.
Well, failure is part of the deal, you know. Though when I approach those kinds of things, I, just like anyone else, I try not to screw up. So I worked at it when I was a GI. And then when I got out, I had already previously sold a few things as a GI. When I got out of the service, I hung out over there kind of as a bum. And I did leather work and sold wallets to GIs.
So was there a trick to selling it? What did GIs look for?
Well, there's a type of rolling papers, and many of the GIs smoke pot. And the type of papers is called zigzag, and there's like a Romanian-looking guy on the picture of it. And I was able to tool that image right onto the leather, and any GI that saw that wallet would have to buy it.
So you were a shrewd businessman as well as an artisan.
I only had several hundred dollars in my pocket. And, you know, of course, $100 went a lot farther in Germany. So, you know, I was trying to make a couple bucks here and there to kind of just stay ahead of the eight ball. I had a free place to stay. I didn't pay rent.
Where did you learn to be a craftsman and a woodworker and a carpenter?
I just became a residential carpenter.
In Germany?
No. It was later on, a few years later, I realized it was time to buckle down. I was probably 23, 24, and I broke up with my girlfriend and went back to the States and decided to become a carpenter and just get hired on a job, do whatever I could do. I could fake it. I'd go on a job site and tell them I knew how to do it, and then I'd watch everybody and copy them. I was good at using my body. That was all the way back from way back. And so being a carpenter requires some of that. And then I did residential carpentry like that with different crews for a few years. And I had the GI Bill at my disposal. And then I got married, moved to Arkansas, and went to vocational carpenter school. And learned a number of things about being a carpenter. Now, being a fine woodworker is not really the same as being a carpenter.
When did that interest strike home for you?
It just kind of evolved in reading about woodworking. And since I was a carpenter, I just was interested in wood. And since I played guitar my whole life, that had a bearing on wood. And a residential carpenter, you'd see a lot of nice wood trim, and I knew how to do that. And eventually I moved to Alaska, you know, after a number of years of being a carpenter. And just one day someone said, you know, you ought to try building one of those. And they were talking about a guitar, and kind of a light bulb went off, and I realized, wow, yeah, I could probably do that. And maybe someday make a couple bucks at doing luthier work.
That's musician and luthier Greg Pacetti, and you're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. As you heard, Greg was born and raised in Florida, where his dad was a fisherman. Many of Greg's songs are informed by his past. Here he is singing Ocean of My Life. When we return, a cautionary note to parents thinking of buying their kids a guitar.
I was born in a town not far from the sea. Not just any body of water, the Gulf Stream, where my daddy fished for 20 odd years, pulling anchor and bucking the sea. Mama, she was raising brother, sister, and me, and I can still smell the salty breeze. Oh.
Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking this segment with musician and luthier Greg Pacetti. I continued our discussion by asking Greg about his first guitar.
When you're young and you're learning, or at any age, learning to play guitar, you want to be able to finger it without having to stand on top of the strings to get them to go down. So cheap guitars, could back then especially, were really hard to deal with your hands. So, you know, therein lies why you shouldn't have a real cheap guitar, you know. So back when I was a young man, a cheap guitar would be $60. Nowadays, a cheap guitar would be $300. And generally are built quite a bit better than that cheap guitar when I was a kid.
So when you were playing a guitar, when you started playing a guitar, did you want to be in a rock band? Did you like folk music?
Yeah. Well, I listened to popular music a lot, and so generally every young person that's playing an instrument, you envision yourself playing professionally. It's just kind of a natural thing. You know, when I was in high school, I had a pretty darn good guitar then, and I played with another guy, and we kind of did duet stuff.
So a guitar accompanied you no matter where you went. It was always with you.
At the beginning of it. In early high school, I got a Martin D21, which I still have, which is a real good guitar. That was the best one I got as a young person. And it went into the military with me and went everywhere I went, which was a pain in the butt carrying around a big dreadnought.
I'll bet it was.
But it was an enjoyable pain.
as you developed as a musician, Grady, did you determine what made a great guitar? Was it materials? Was it the construction or the wood?
It was both materials and the design. You know, as a young adult, I had sales people that sold nice guitars. They reaffirmed what I just said, that, you know, the design, the way it's put together. In those early days, Martin and Gibson were kind of like a big deal, though to this day I still prefer a Martin. But I've learned a lot of things about different guitars around the world.
So combining your skill with wood and your love of music and your musicianship, when you built your first guitar, what did you strive for? How did you find a form and how did you go about it?
First of all, because I played a Martin guitar for many years, that was the benchmark audio-wise, you know. So if I built the guitar, I wanted it to emulate some of the aspects on the interior, not necessarily the exact materials or species of wood, although it ought to be a spruce top. And so that was sort of where I started from. And the first steel string guitar I built, I still have, and it's an awesome guitar.
Describe what a steel string guitar is opposed to a nylon or a...
Well, a classical guitar has nylon strings, and steel string guitars has a combination of steel and bronze or nickel wrapped around the fat strings. The skinny strings are just plain steel. That's what a steel string guitar is. It inherently has a bright, punchy sound. The nylon string guitar has a kind of a warmer, round tone, but it's easy to tell the difference, you know, listening. Though I like the sound of both a lot.
Is the design of a steel string guitar different than a nylon string guitar?
Yeah. The interior, meaning the bracing of the top mostly. Bracing of the back is a big deal. The classical guitars generally have a different shape. The 12th fret connects at the body. In most steel string guitars, the 14th fret connects at the body. That element has a major degree on where the placement of the bridge is. So classicals are different, but they function the same way.
Well, let me break out a couple of things as we discuss the construction of a guitar. The bridge is that raised piece of wood that holds the strings above the fretboard, right?
Yeah, the bridge is where the strings connect to the body of the guitar at the bridge. There's different ways of connecting the strings. Then the strings rise out of the bridge and go across a separate small member called the saddle. They run along the fretboard and they break over another separate piece called the nut. A lot of saddles are bone, a lot of nuts are bone. The strings break at those points. Conduction of sound, vibrations, you know, go into the body of the guitar at the saddle.
But so I'm guessing it's that top piece of wood on a guitar that resonates when the strings are plucked or
right. Are
strummed that determines the quality of the sound out of a guitar. Would I be right?
It determines the character and the way it's braced underneath. That member that we're talking about, the top of the guitar, or the top of a ukulele, or the top of a violin, is called the soundboard. It's critical that it's made out of a light enough material and dimensioned thin enough that it can really vibrate easily. So it has a bearing on the character of the sound. The back of it moves as well, and it pumps air through the sound hole. That has a bearing on the sound as well.
When you built your first guitar, what kind of material did you want for your soundboard in the body?
Sitka spruce, which is very, very popular, and there's a lot of it. Plus, there's a bunch of it in Alaska, so I tried to get my Sitka spruce in Alaska. The back and sides are made of bubinga, which is an African exotic. It looks like rosewood.
Obviously, you look for the beauty of the wood itself, but these woods have properties that make them good acoustically, too, I'm guessing.
Most of the standard luthier woods have those properties. Beauty has a big play on it. But, you know, you could buy the ideal rosewood, which is Brazilian rosewood, and if you don't build it properly, you know, it ain't going to sound better because it's Brazilian rosewood. And same token, you could buy a wood that's not considered a great tone wood, and if you do certain things to it as you build it, it could end up sounding fabulous. A wood that's very commonly used in the industry that's considered kind of a lower grade to a certain degree, especially in its look, is mahogany. And it makes an incredibly great instrument in any kind of instrument, especially Honduran mahogany, which there's not as much of anymore. So, you know, how you deal with the wood as you're building the guitar, it has more of a bearing on all of that than anything. But there's certain standard things that you do. So that's how I got started. Though I started building string instruments by building a dobro instead of a steel string guitar.
Now, a dobro sits on your lap, right?
Yeah, a dobro is a resophonic instrument. It was designed and invented in, the 40s. That's how I broke into the idea of making an instrument. So I built one of those, and I've built several since then.
Now, would you sell these, Grady? Is that?
Yeah, I sold them. They were pretty darn good. And I knew I was going to eventually build a guitar because many of the methods for dealing with the parts transfers over to building a steel string guitar. I got some books and kind of evolved into doing a regular guitar.
That's luthier and musician Greg Pacetti, my guest this segment on Northern Soundings. Here's Greg on his song, Distance Worth the Gain. When we return, don't call the ukulele a toy.
I was born to the quest and the knowledge at best. Seldom would I ever go lame. My youth had the wisdom and the strength you would give them. And the distance is worth the gain. I sported the dreams that a Westerner's schemes. Mama and Papa would try. The young man could see there was something more to be, so he rode on fire in his eye.
Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with Greg Pacetti, luthier and musician. One of Greg's more recent passions is the ukulele. Let's return to our conversation.
In the midst of building dobros a number of years ago, someone called me up, said, "Hey, Greg, you need to come over now. There's a Hawaiian guy here that plays uke and sings, and you got to check this out." So I went over to their house, and this guy was there. And sure enough, he played the heck out of the ukulele and sang a lot of songs. And I listened to him, and I thought, oh my, that ukulele sounds fantastic. You know, it was just a beautiful sound. And then I grabbed it, went into a room by myself and messed around on it and thought, well, I'm going to have to build one of these now. This is a real instrument. This is not a toy. A lot of people think that they're kind of a toy, and I can understand that, but they're not.
Are there principles that connect building an instrument to building a cabinet, to building a house?
Well, knowing how to use some power tools transfers over to that.
I guess.
A stringed instrument, building one, is dealing with something that's very fragile. So at any given moment, you can ruin the instrument. In a house, if you screwed up a piece of trim, you just go grab another piece and put it up. It's much more forgiving.
You often hear in building a house, you have to have a great foundation, a secure foundation.
Yeah.
What's the foundation for building a good instrument?
Courage, not being afraid to fail.
Your wife, Marcia Traynor, is an artist, a photographer. She does amazing work. She's a storyteller. You are a musician. You're a craftsman. It seems like you're motivated more on crafting a beautiful item than on selling it. I mean, you don't seem too concerned about making sure you sell all the things you create.
Well, since we live in Fairbanks, kind of like the end of civilization, sort of, and it's hard to market anything. There is a renaissance of musical instrument making in the United States right now, so it's highly competitive. I'm able to pursue it because my house is paid for. I'm kind of semi-retired. I got enough funds to kind of pursue this. I've acquired materials over the last 10 years. I have a number of materials that I can build several instruments right now, right out of the box. And I'm just not motivated to hustle it up and try to market it.
Is there some satisfaction you get about crafting a new instrument?
Oh, I get huge satisfaction coming to an end result that I like. I'm more interested in ukuleles right now instead of guitars. The cute factor is off the charts, so I kind of like
on a uke.
I go for that. But you're right, I'm not very motivated to make a buck on it, so I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen with the ukes. I got 3 or 4 going right now.
Every time you create one, is it your favorite for a while? And do you have any instruments that you've built that you just can't bear to part with?
Well, they are like children, but no, there's been several that I didn't mind parting with. I did a new design on my ukes of a different body shape, and by the way, I only build tenor ukes, which is a specific size, and it's probably the most popular size. I did a new design of the shape, which I now think is best. Got a little better punch of tone coming out of the instrument.
If you play the guitar, can you pick up the ukulele pretty naturally, or is the fingering different? How does playing a ukulele differ from a guitar?
If you play guitar, it's kind of a natural to go to ukulele. There is 4 strings, and if you take the 4 strings on a guitar, starting at the highest string, the skinniest string, and you go up towards your chin, those first 4 strings are similar on a uke. And what I mean by that, if you create a specific type of chord on the guitar with just 2 fingers, a similar chord appears on a ukulele in the same position. And so therefore, if you play guitar and you pick up a uke, if you think in those terms, you'll be able to make some chords.
You and Marcia, a number of years ago, created a CD called Sunday Drive. When you go to write a song, tell me about telling a story musically.
It just starts with an idea, and if it really wants to happen, it blossoms like a flower. I suppose you can force it out of yourself if you practice all the time at writing, as in poetry or songs. But generally, with my personal history with writing songs, and I'm not prolific, an idea will just pop out of my mouth while I'm playing guitar, along with whatever I'm playing on the guitar. And if the iron is hot, it'll just pop right out. Hmm. It'll probably be done in 10 minutes.
Hmm. Will the sound of an instrument inspire you sometimes?
It inspires me. I have many, many musical ideas on the instrument that are not lyrics, that are just chord progressions and melody formats. I have lots of them. They flow out pretty regularly. Lyrics are much more difficult. But, you know, I'm not trying to lay down tracks and record and all that. So I do it to entertain myself, keep my chops going on the guitar, practicing. I occasionally pick up the ukulele, and so I don't practice on that much. I mostly play guitar, and especially the one I recently built, as in the last couple of years, this particular guitar, which is a Gypsy Jazz hybrid.
Well, Greg Pacetti, I want to thank you for talking with me today.
You bet.
We'll go out with Greg Pacetti strumming on one of his guitars. An hour after our conversation, he texted me to let me know that what he's really looking forward to in his semi-retirement is spending time with his grandkids and family. When we return, Putting to Sea for Science. Listening to Northern Sounding, support of the show comes from listeners like you and from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. Longtime listeners of Northern Soundings may remember my next guest. Roger Topp is director of exhibits at the University of Alaska Museum of the North. He's also a top fencer and serious writer. Last August, just before Northern Soundings went on a summer break, I talked to Roger about a voyage he was going to make on UAF's research vessel, Sikuliak. As it happens, before he turned his attention to the arts, Roger received his master's degree from UAF in oceanography. He jumped at the chance to revisit with scientists he knew and report on the research. While we're in a completely different season from when Roger and I talked, his passion for communicating science and the ocean voyage seemed like a good fit for this program. As it happens, he says he wasn't a newbie on the research vessel.
Yeah, this time on the fourth trip on Sikuliak, the first one in 3 years. So it's like I've never been on board before because the ship has evolved in 3 years, I guarantee it. It was a shakedown cruise last time. They were still figuring out how the ship works and how to run science off it. This will be the first time since 1995 I've been on a ship doing an active research project with definitive goals, scientists having paid for the ship, and time being a big factor in getting done what they want to have done. So it's a 3.5-week cruise up on the Beaufort Sea, and I know that every hour of every day will be booked to get things done. So this is a shelf break cruise.
So what does that mean?
The ship is going to transect lines from the shelf off the northern coast of Alaska into the deeper water and then come back into the shallower water. So there's a shelf break there where the continental shelf dips off and the ocean becomes a lot deeper all of a sudden. And it's a very interesting place because the winds, which when they blow from the east across the shelf, they move the water out of the way and you have deeper, colder, more nutrient-rich water tends to rup well in these regions right there on the shelf break. And so that has a lot of implications for the biology.
Mm. Let's break some of these pieces out. The experiments, what will your role be? Because I think of you as a museum director for exhibits. What do you do on the Sikuliak?
Yeah, this is not a museum job. This is one of my other great loves of writing job. So I'm there on board as a writer and a photographer, provide outreach for the scientists. It's obviously a piece of the grant requirement of the NSF proposal to do outreach. And so my job is to look at the science, see what's happening, and to tell stories about the scientists, about the ship itself, about the kinds of research, about the importance of the research, what the implications are. And because it's me on board and not someone else, there's probably going to be a lot of perspective backstory, previous cruises, previous expeditions on land, on sea. I've worked with some of these scientists several times before. Other scientists will be the first time I've met them. And there we are going to be cooped up on a 264-foot boat for 28 days. So
that could be a good thing or a not-so-good thing.
It's always a good thing, but it's always a community, and you develop relationships and how people work, and it's part of the job of outreach is figuring out how to tell those stories, and everyone's a little different.
When we think about telling stories in science, obviously most of us aren't scientists, so the numbers are maybe intimidating or mystifying. How do you go about trying to put a human angle and hook to that?
My favorite angle, and when talking about oceanographers, and I had a master's in oceanography way back in the 90s, and so I understand a little bit about the science, which could be dangerous in that some of it I take for granted. We're going to put moorings in the water with ADCPs and,
another alphabet number.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Really human angle is what I'm interested in. I'm interested in seeing Steve Okunin again. I saw him briefly this spring when he came through Fairbanks, but I want to know what he's been doing since. I'm going to ask him about his fishing down there in the Gulf and how the commercial fishing is going, as well as how the science is going. I want to find out, you know, why these three scientists always work together on these boats. I mean, they must really work together well. So I'm interested in the people and why they're doing the science. And then around that, yeah, there's hardware. There's anchoring moorings to the bottom of the ocean with big railroad wheels, and there's lots of heavy gear and lines and dangerous winch operations. And that's just I think part of the these people like being there all the time.
Yeah. But if you're a gear geek, that it's kind of cool.
It's great too. It's electronics and water.
What's not to like?
And you know, I came up to Alaska in 93 to do oceanography. And my research then was mooring research off the east coast of Greenland. We put current meters in the water, leave them there for a year, go back a year later, pick them back up again, get the data. I didn't get to do that in 93. That data was already collected when I got here. So now in 2018, be the first time I've actually been on a ship that's putting the kind of moorings in the water that I was using data from back in 1993, 95. And so it's going to be the first time I've seen some of this operation done. But I'm certainly going to talk about that span of time and being out of oceanography and coming back to it and why I like being at sea.
Do we have a good picture, a chronology about how change is taking place in this region,
no,
Roger?
No, we don't. This is the Beaufort Sea. It's part of the Arctic Ocean. We know the big changes going on there involve the ice. The minimum ice extent in September has been shrinking. I mean, it fluctuates, but it's generally been shrinking over the years. But we don't have the data from 20 years ago in the same place in the way that we're collecting it now. And I think one of the, and here I'm speaking for scientists without having talked to them this week, right, is saying that I think one of the problems we're having, and this is not just in oceanography, is that we're seeing change happen rapidly without having a good baseline. And so there's this rush to get a baseline, to see what things are like now, knowing that they're going to be different in 10 years, knowing that they've already changed in the past 10 years. So I think that's what's driving part of it. I think they know there's change happening. If you know that this area, the shelf break, is very important to the beluga population. My own personal experience is 2004, I was part of an immersion camp off this coast there, and we were going out in 14-foot open boats, and they were seal hunting. I was there to observe. And we did this from the coast in open 14-foot boats, and we waited on the shore until the ice came in, and you could see it come right into shore, and then we'd go out among the ice floes, and they would hunt for seals. That was July. And there is, I understand, there's very little chance we'll see any ice. But, you know, so things have potentially changed a lot in 14 years.
Mm. Let's turn to the Sikuliak now. And you say you're expecting a lot has changed. But what kind of changes are you anticipating? And what changes do ships go through?
Yeah, I think about a ship like a house. Actually, I think the betterment, think of a ship like an apartment building. It has all the features you need. It has the heating systems, the air conditioning systems. It has the windows. It has maintenance. It is elevated. All those pieces are there, and people live there. And the architect designs this, and the engineers come in, and they say, I got to put a duct there because we need a duct. And then you have people actually living there. And then you have people bringing in furniture, right? The chief steward, he's running his kitchen. And he wants a certain mixer, you know, or the mixer that's there when he gets to the kitchen isn't appropriate for being at high sea when you have large rocking of the boat. And so they learn to live on the ship in terms of just living accommodations as well as the actual science, how the winches work. And there's always issues. I just say kicking the tires in, you know, retightening the bolts. And that's largely the job of the science techs and the crew of the ship as they start to live on the vessel. Replacing the doorknobs for ones that actually close the way they want them to. Sometimes it's not a matter of this doesn't work, that works, but this will work better for us. And so those changes have happened. But I'm interested in seeing some of the crew. I was on the ship in 2013, and I'm looking forward to seeing how they live on the ship now.
I just had an opportunity to talk to Susan Henricks, and she was talking about the old Alpha Helix and what a nightmare it was collecting water samples there, but they have a whole room now dedicated that they can extract the samples without freezing, having them freeze, and their hands, of course, freeze too.
Absolutely. While I didn't get to go to Greenland to collect my data when I was a student here, a certain professor named Susan Henricks invited me on board the Alpha Helix in 1995 to help her collect water and mud samples. So that was my first research cruise, was with Susan, and it was a very different time.
And then that's the other component. I'm guessing with the advance of computers, will you be filing from the field, or do you tend to acquire all the material and then sift and stitch together stuff afterwards?
What we say, and I don't know if it's exactly true, but it's easier to get images from Mars than from a ship sometimes. And it does depend on which direction the ship is pointing, how many other ships are nearby, how many ships are tasking the satellites. But data to and from the ship is difficult. And there are priorities. Priority is the ship itself, its safety, its navigation, what the captain's needs are. Second priority is what the chief scientist's needs are. They need to get data to shore, because for the science, that's most important. And then lastly, of course, is your outreach, your Instagram photos. And yeah, we can use a phone on the ship with Instagram and take snapshots and send them ashore. They might take a little while to get there. And we do use a shoreside server to send video, audio files. But yeah, absolutely, we're filing every day. I have backup plans for loading blog sites, in the case that I can't actually access that deep into the internet while on ship, and I send just JPEGs and text files to shore. So we sort of have a series of backup plans. But we hope to have some connectivity, but real time, no.
I've had a chance to talk with guys like Matthew Sturm, who just love the history of Arctic exploration and the isolation and months and years of separation from human civilization as they go about looking at things and trying to discover. And we're talking about the 19th century, 18th, 19th century. Some of that romance is gone, don't you think?
Maybe, but I tell you, I don't think there's any scientist on board who doesn't relish the opportunity to say, oh, sorry, I will be out of contact for a month. As I'm telling people here that emails should not be a problem. It might take me a few hours to get the email and get back to you. Don't put attachments in, please. So it's not as if we're out of contact. It's not as like it was in 1995. I remember then having to go down to the very bowels of the ship, and there was an old computer down there and a little monochrome screen, and you basically could send your email as a text, and you would, but it wouldn't go into, it wasn't a normal email. It would go into a file, and even the email would wait for some time later in the day and would be packaged off to shore as a batch. We have a little better connectivity now than we did then.
Since you worked with these guys before, how much of, you talked about their backstory, how much do you think that background experience on earlier voyages with them or work with them play into your approach and storytelling going forward?
A great deal of the time when I write, I'm looking for change in people. I'm interested in Steve, in Karen, in Kate, in Vern, in Ethan. These are people I know are going to be on the ship who I've met before. I worked with Karen up on Barrow on the ice. I'm sorry, Kate. I've worked with Karen on ship. And I really sort of want to see where they've gone. I know how different my life is now 5 years on, and I'm interested in how their life has changed. And these are people who were doing science then, who are doing science now. And science is something I left behind back in the 90s, turned to writing, turned to, you know, museum education and museum exhibits. And so I'm really just personally interested in how they've changed and yet doing the same thing in some ways that they used to do. It must change somehow. So I'm very much interested in that. And without, I think that prior experience with them maybe allows us to have a different kind of conversation.
I'll bet.
You know,
sure.
We've known each other for quite a while, right?
Yeah.
It'd be quite different if we hadn't actually met before we sat down today. And so that's, I think that lends some interesting perspective on things. I have my own agenda on the ship. Obviously, I'm there to outreach the science, but I'm there as well to to think about my history at sea and on expeditions and travel and looking at science from the inside and the outside and how that's changed for me over the years.
How we report or how we tell stories has changed somewhat. I think of John McPhee, for example, some of his geological writings, Basin and Range and those that followed, and where he would focus on the researcher, and we got to know the researcher, and then he kind of feed in a lot of the information that we might be intimidated about. Mm-hmm. But I think since McPhee's day, it's much more common for us to get to know the writer, the storyteller, and use the storyteller's personality and insights as a way to navigate through the material. Do you have a preference one way or the other, Roger?
No, I definitely do. It's probably unfair, but I equate the former there to more of a journalistic approach, where the journalist should not be a part of the story most of the time, at least. Whereas my approach is almost always, I'm a part of the story. I am not a journalist. I am not going to write in a way that separates me from the subject. It is my filter. And I more so, I think that filter is important in this kind of writing. I think that helps in museum exhibits, right? That's interpretation is the art of connecting the visitor to the content. That's why I call it interpretation.
Right.
It's not an unfiltered viewpoint. It's heavily filtered. So that is definitely my approach. Mm. I tell everybody, look, if I'm going to write about this cruise, I am a part of the story. And I'm going to use whatever tools I have. It's creative nonfiction, right? I want to use whatever sort of literary tools I have to tell a story.
Right.
It's not going to be linear. It's not going to be by the hour. A recounting of events.
Long.
No,
we're on the ocean again.
Lots of tangents, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a rich body, of course, maritime literature. Do you ever tap into that, Roger, and try to bring historical elements to bear?
Like rereading Moby Dick.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't. No,
yeah.
If the
captain goes after a white whale, I would get off the ship as soon as you can.
I'm really coming. I have a degree in oceanography, but I'm coming outside of the box. I just started Ian Banks' Raw Spirit last night. And if you know Ian Banks, he's well-known science fiction as well as literary author. And he's got one book of nonfiction. It's called Raw Spirit. And it's about his travels around Scotland looking for the best whiskey, which he admits in the first chapter is impossible, but he'll take the money. He'll make the travel. He'll go.
He'll drink the whiskey.
But it's really interesting about reading. I mean, he's who I'm reading before I get on the boat, and that's decided because it's intention that I'm going to travel, and he says this in his introduction. I'm going to invite friends along. Sometimes they'll be strangers. Sometimes we'll be people I know. Sometimes we'll be in cars or walking, and he's just saying here is a variety of circumstances, and yeah, we're going to go to different distilleries. But his point is you can see he's just kind of setting up the idea of conversing, how we think about, in this case, whiskey, more so than the actual weather. He admits he's not qualified to actually tell you which is the best whiskey.
I love him as a writer. Okay, if folks want to tap into when will the pieces be available and where do they go?
The pieces about the trip will probably begin August 1st, which is when I get on a plane and head to Nome. The ship itself leaves Nome on the 3rd, comes back on the 28th. The blogs will be at thewellandthewicked.com, which is my blog.
Mm. Well, Roger Topp, his day job is director of exhibits at the University of Alaska Museum, but when he can escape, he goes out on voyages whenever he can. Roger, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Robert. It's always a pleasure.
Links to Roger's blog can be found at the Northern Soundings website. When we return, Chris Lott and Cachexit Clippings. Thank you. Here's Chris with some musical notes.
Browsing master luthier Greg Pacetti's shop blog inspired melancholy and joy. Melancholy, remembering my long-lost dreams of becoming a rock guitar god, and in sympathy for all who had to see the unfortunate perm I acquired at the time. And joy, bordering on lust, taking in the pictures of the ravishing instruments he creates. While I was never musically worthy of, or in an income bracket to afford, an instrument like those Pacetti crafts, I was inspired to go on a little meander of musical words, starting with the word guitar itself. There is no question that the modern word guitar, which comes to us from the Spanish guitarra, ultimately derives from the Greek kithara, an ancient Greek musical instrument. You would be forgiven for guessing that other similarly named instruments, such as the sitar and zither, share this origin, but in fact the commonality there is the tar suffix, an Arabic word for string. At any rate, the seven-stringed kithara, which looks like a small harp, was a virtuoso's version of the lyra, a similarly shaped stringed folk instrument. The kithara, though, was mostly employed by professional performers called kitharodes. Mastery of the kithara, forerunner to the guitar, was considered so challenging that the Greek deity Apollo, god of music, truth, prophecy, and healing, is often depicted playing one in much the same way I picture Robert Johnson, Stevie Ray Vaughan, and Jimi Hendrix jamming in the ballroom of the six-string version of Mount Olympus. But someone has to build the instruments these modern gods make their music with, and makers of guitars are a kind of luthier, a term whose roots were murky but which I suspected were unrelated to Martin Luther and Lutheranism, the only words that came to mind of similar construction. The title of luthier, a maker of stringed instruments, particularly of the violin and guitar families, aka the craft of luthery, is derived from the word lute, the pear-shaped, guitar-like instrument that was particularly popular from the 14th to 17th centuries, and at Renaissance fairs and on television shows like Black Hatter today. The original luthier was literally a crafter of lutes. And lute has an interesting history as well, being an adaptation of earlier French and Provençal terms lute and lout, all of which go back to the Arabic al-oud, literally the wood or a piece of wood. Thanks to a process called rebracketing, the same thing we see in the English word apron, which is basically a misdivision of the phrase an apron, the Western pronunciation of the Arabic al-oud became a lute, and finally lute, while in Arab countries no rebracketing occurred and the oud, O-U-D, a kind of cross between a lute and a mandolin, remains a popular instrument there today. Many more common words with musical roots, or that serve purposes both musical and not, have become part of our lexicon. Psalm, for instance, comes from the Greek psallein, P-S-A-L-L-E-I-N, to pluck a musical instrument, and chord, originally a shortening of accord, as in agreement, now refers not just to notes in musical harmony, but has uses that span the gamut, from geometry, construction, and aeronautics, to astronomy, computer networking, and even keyboarding methods. Some musical roots, though, are significantly more obscured than others. The gamut, G-A-M-U-T, or the broad range or scope that those usages of the word chord span, that's originally a musical word, too. Gamut first referred to the low G, the lowest note in the medieval musical scale, and is a contraction of the Greek letter gamma, used at the time to refer to the note below the A at the beginning of the scale, and ut, the low note on a six-note singing scale based on the initial syllables, ut, re, mi, fa, sol, la, of the words of Ut Quiant Laxis, a hymn sung for St. John the Baptist Day that happened to feature the notes in ascending order at the beginning of each phrase. These syllabic singable scales for Western music, such as do, re, mi, etc., are called solfa, named after two of the syllables, sol, fa, in the scale, and to sing them, as Julie Andrews does so memorably in The Sound of Music, is likewise two solfa. The process of creating systems like this, and they naturally exist in many languages around the world, is called solmization, also derived from the two common scale syllables, this time sol and mi. Thanks for listening to my musically inspired meander. For links to luthier Greg Pacetti's work, to read the lyrics or listen to a beautiful performance of Ut Quiant Laxis, or to listen to this or any other episode of Catexic Words, point your browser to catexic.com/KUAC.
we'll go out the show with Don't Put On a Freeze, another cut from Greg Pacetti's album Sunday Drive. I'm your host of Northern Soundings, Robert Hannon. You can find us on iTunes. Thanks for joining me, and we'll see you next week.
There ain't no use, no use, no doubt. When you're doing without. So wipe that silly grin from your face. Jump right in and buckle up. Saddle in and saddle up. There ain't no one who'll ever take your place. So don't you put on a freeze. I'm sailing on my knees. That old ghost town won't come around. It's your love that please. Called last night, but called too late. You were out, I'm so free. I wonder if there's something coming down.
You better believe it, babe.
I know sometimes I can be dumb. Don't turn me loose, I'll come undone. Fill my cup, baby, now I'm hanging around. Don't you put on a freeze. I'm sailing on my knees. That old ghost town won't come around. It's your love that I please. Somebody help me, please. Don't you put on a freeze. I'm sailing on my knees. The old ghost town won't come around. Your love that'll please. Romeo and Robin Hood on Broadway or Hollywood. My heart is fixed upon that stage. I cast my fate into the wind, into the story that'll never end. Curtain calls and we're on. So don't you put on a freeze. I'm sailing on my knees. That old ghost town won't come around. It's your love that'll please. Ain't no use, no use, no doubt. When you're done without. So wipe that silly grin from your face. Yeah, jump right in and buckle up. Saddle in and saddle up. Ever take your place. Curtain calls and we're on our way. Curtain calls and we're on our way.